Meanwhile, to set the scene, let's go live to Augusta, bring in our own Tom Rinaldi, the exceptional reporter who's down there covering for us. He's on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. And so here we are as things get going. Tom, how would you describe the scene there this morning as compared to your previous experience at Augusta on this first day of the Masters?
144 days, Greeny. Finally, it is here. He returns to competitive golf. The whole week has been strange, and so there's been a little conflict between Augusta National's desire to always have business as usual, and yet, just even yesterday, Greeny, Billy Payne, in his remarks, sort of analogous, as I said, on SportsCenter to a chairman, rather a commissioner of a sport, talking about his respective league, speaking about one player with very pointed remarks, that just talks to how different the atmosphere is this week.
How was that received? Billy Payne really, you know, we kind of had a little fun with it. We thought the presidential seal should have been in front of him with the flag waving behind him, kind of with the way that statement was going. How were those statements received?
I'll tell you, they raised a lot of eyebrows, Mike, in the press room and outside the press room. I think people were very surprised that he, I wouldn't say veered off script, because obviously they were prepared remarks, but that he chose to speak about Woods directly and in such a pointed way, the tone that he adopted during those remarks. You know, usually that is a very pro forma speech, and this obviously was not part of the script from previous years, so it raised a lot of eyebrows.
As we're having this discussion, I think for those who haven't heard it, we need to make sure people hear what we're talking about. Guys, let's have 11:505. Let me know when that's ready. Here was Billy Payne. Again, he's the chairman at Augusta National, talking and in the comments that we're discussing here, really in pointed terms about Tiger. Here's part of what he said.
It is not simply the degree of his conduct that is so egregious here. It is the fact that he disappointed all of us, and more importantly, our kids and our grandkids. Our hero did not live up to the expectations of the role model we sought for our children.
Now, he did talk a lot about second chances and all that. It was not all critical of Tiger Woods, but certainly, I think, certainly Mike and I were very surprised that he went as far as that yesterday. So, Tom, it has been an unusual week in a lot of ways. How about as far as the fans there, the spectators, as they're called, the patrons at Augusta? Do you see anything different about them over the course of the week and this morning as the event gets underway?
I really do, Greeny, and that's a very good question. And I will say, just in terms of an on-the-ground sampling, which certainly is not going to be the same as the sampling you receive from across the country, because these are golf fans who are going to go through the trouble and the effort and the desire to get on the ground at Augusta National. But I really think for the galleries we saw, Monday was a turning point. I thought the reception that he received, even though it built on Monday into a more positive vibe, was far from a crescendo. I felt on Tuesday and again yesterday, people were, in a sense, more comfortable being vocally supportive of him. And the vast majority, I didn't hear a single negative comment all week. The difference was the volume and the passion of the positive and supportive comments as the week went on, in particular Tuesday and yesterday.
Are people expecting a different Tiger Thursday through Sunday? You know, we talked about being more accessible to fans and especially kids. Is the expectation he'll do that during the tournament?
That's another good question, Mike. I don't know. And he tried to temper that a little bit in the press conference remarks on Monday by saying, look, it's probably going to be different here on Thursday than it was in terms of making the eye contact or doing some of the other things where he was reaching out toward galleries. When he's in the competitive crucible, I think it's going to be, I think we're probably going to see someone in many ways similar to the man we saw 144 days ago, when the last time he played competitively. And that's got to be deep in his DNA and a part of what he thinks is his path to success on the course. That'll be just one of the things that's riveting about watching his round today.
You'll be able to watch it, of course, on ESPN today, on ESPN TV and ESPN3.com. Final one for me, Tom Rinaldi, live at Augusta. How about the reactions of KJ Choi and Matt Kuchar, who will be his playing partners today? How do they feel about that?
You know, KJ is great. His nickname is Tank, and he kind of, I think, in a sense, considering where he's come from and all that he's achieved, that's kind of how he moves through life. He said an official told him on the back nine during a practice round on Tuesday, and his initial reaction was, Mr. KJ Choi, Tiger Woods, together, good, good news. I think he feels really good about it. Matt Kuchar, you know, who played with Tiger back in the 98 Masters and is a player on the rise right now, playing well, I think he feels excited about the opportunity, more based on his own play than about being with Tiger, but certainly nothing even close to a negative comment from either guy, including the group that's directly in front of him, Greeny, which is important because that's the group that gets disturbed more by the motions surrounding Tiger Woods galleries. And Steve Stricker, for example, or Ian Poulter said, I don't think it's going to be a problem. I think it'll be fine.
Very good. Tom Rinaldi with our eyes and ears on the ground at Augusta. Certainly you'll be seeing him on ESPN's coverage throughout the day. Thank you, Tom. Let's check in tomorrow morning.
Enjoy Pittsburgh, guys, and hit the O for me.
Thank you. We will do our best. Tom Rinaldi with us.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
Let's go back live to Augusta and bring in two-time U.S. Open champion and ESPN's own Andy North, who's with us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Andy, you've been going to Augusta for a really long time. You played in the Masters many times, and you've certainly seen the uniqueness of that event. How has this year thus far been unique because of the Tiger Woods factor?
Well, we've never seen anything like this before. You have no game plan of how to deal with all this. But I thought things went very smoothly on Monday, and it's gotten closer to being golf as normal, working your way toward Thursday. I would suspect this afternoon there'll be quite a buzz around the tee at 142 when Tiger is getting ready to tee off. But I would think once he hits it and plays a couple of holes, then it's just a matter of can you figure out how to play your best.
Can you equate his first drive off the first tee today with anything else in his career, if you try and put yourself in his shoes on what he may be going through?
You know, I don't know. I think it's he has done this so many times. Yes, it's going to be different. I thought the hardest thing he had to do was the press conference on Monday. Once that got over with, then you're sort of getting closer to some normal patterns. But he'll be nervous, as every player is, every time you tee off on the first hole of any major championship. So it's just a matter of his focus, and is he anywhere near ready to go?
Mike and Andy North, you know, we've talked so much about the psychology of all of this. Would you guess, if you had to just take a guess, if Tiger Woods plays poorly today, and we have notes that suggest he has never broken 70 in the first round of the Masters, if he plays poorly today, the world will look at it and say, well, obviously, you know, it was because of all that's happened the last few months. Would you say there will definitely have to be a cause and effect there? Could you see other circumstances coming into play today?
Well, I think as strong as he has been emotionally and mentally over his career, I would think maybe the biggest thing would be a matter of if he's not prepared physically to play. I think mentally he'll be just fine. I think he'll click in. I really think that he's gotten the worst behind him from a golfing standpoint. There hasn't been any issues here of any kind that have been negative. The people have been very warm to him. I think it's now comes down to, can you hit the ball and putt and do the things you need to do to play well?
Was his decision to play the Masters as his first tournament this year, did that have more to do with golf or the surrounding circumstances?
I think it's probably some of both. He has a great love for here. It's a major championship. It's a situation to where there is some control. There's better security here. Just anybody can't walk in off the street, so that was a big part of it. And from what I understand, he didn't feel like he's anywhere near ready to play a week or two ago.
Mike, Andy North is with us. He's live at Augusta. He won two U.S. Opens during his career. Now, help us with this, Andy, because when an athlete comes back in other sports, you will say, well, they haven't been up to game speed. A football player, you can practice other things all you want, but the game is a different speed. Basketball, the game is a different speed. Golf, if he's playing the same golf course, he's been practicing at Augusta a good deal lately. If he's playing the same golf course, what makes it different today?
Well, it's all just the, it gets amped up once you get in the tournament. He hasn't hit chip shots and pitch shots under tournament pressure. You know, you can try to manufacture pressure when you're practicing, and we all do that. but it's a little bit different. Hitting that first 6-foot putt, you know, hitting, having to hit, you know, a cut around a tree someplace. You know, you practice all that stuff, but until you do it in the tournament, then you feel more comfortable, and I think that's what it's going to take. It might take him 3 or 4 holes to sort of click in. Maybe it'll take him a whole round. Sometimes you can, you know, maybe he knocks it over the first green, hits a nice pitch back about 7 feet, and knocks in the putt for par. Walk in the second hole, he'll be talking, say, you know, I'm okay. I feel fine. And it's just a matter of making yourself believe that you're all right.
How much do you expect his demeanor to be different in these next 4 days on the golf course in dealing with the surroundings?
Well, I think he's going to try to. I think this is a big part of what he's going through to be a better person in a lot of different aspects in his life. I think we'll see. You know, it's, you can talk about it. It's like a lot of other things. We've all been around people that talk a good game, but then can they pull it off? Well, let's see how he handles it out there. I think it's would be really, really great for our business if he could be a little bit warmer on the golf course. We've seen that in the practice rounds. We've seen a little bit of different Tiger Woods shaking hands, giving balls to little kids. I mean, it's been a very positive thing.
Mike and Mike, Andy North is with us. Normally, on this day, we would have you on, and we'd be talking about the golf course, which they make adjustments to almost every single year. What's that? Well, that's what I'm saying. So let's do that. Yeah, let's do that now. Everyone else and Tiger Woods himself will be playing a golf course that all of us who are fans of the sport know better than any other, because they come back there every year, and we know the azaleas, and we know Amen Corner and all the rest of that. What have they changed this year at Augusta? What makes it particularly difficult? What will be the big challenges this year?
Well, they really haven't done any major, major changes. There's been a couple of tees that the fronts of the tees have been extended to give the players more tee placements, so the tee doesn't get worn out. But there haven't been any really major, major things. The one thing that I think will be a little bit interesting, they've created a new hole placement on the par 5 15th, and they're using it today. It's a front right hole placement. It's to give the players a chance to shoot at that green. It's a little bit dangerous. If you're hitting a third shot in there, you land it on the front fringe, you can spin it back in the water. So I think that gives something to look forward to, is the new hole placement at the 15th.
So more birdies on 15, you think? Eagles on 15?
Well, they're trying to give the players an opportunity to do that, but any time here when the player thinks they've given them an easier opportunity, usually there's more trouble that's brought into play, and by having this front hole location at 15, it brings that water into play. So I think we could have some threes. We probably can have some sixes.
Knowing how the course is set up, and then obviously the weather that's going to be there for the next 4 days, if you're going to be in contention at the end of this tournament, what are a couple of do's you have to make sure you do, and what are a couple of things that you cannot afford to do on this course?
Well, to kind of go at the weather thing first, a front's coming through here this afternoon. What time it hits here, we don't have a great idea. They're talking late afternoon. There could be a little bit of rain, which I think the players would like in a lot of ways. The pollen here has been unbelievable all week long, and it would clean up the air a little bit. I don't think there's going to be enough water to affect golf course very much. But the key here when fronts come through is the wind. If a player teed off this morning and he's on the golf course right now, he has a huge advantage because there's no wind at all. The golf course is going to play as easy as it's going to play all day long. Now, what happens when a front comes through, it will probably blow some tomorrow morning. So the guys that played this afternoon might have a little bit of wind tomorrow morning also before it calms down. So I think the guys playing late this afternoon, as Tiger Woods is doing, may have gotten the worst end of this draw.
Mike and Mike, Andy North. All right, last thing. You always do this for us at the beginning of a major. Let's put you in the clubhouse right now. I'm going to say, Andy North, I'll put you in the clubhouse now, right now, Sunday, 3 under par. Do you win or not?
I've got to go play some green. That will get you a nice check, but it won't get you any wardrobe changes. So I think we're going to have to get to 8, 9 under, something like that. I always love 280 here. If you can break 280, you'll have a chance at the end of the week.
8 or 9 under,
yeah,
to win the Masters this week. So you don't think the wind is going to be that significant. All right, we'll see. We'll keep an eye on all this. Andy North, we will check in with you tomorrow morning, and we always appreciate it. Thank you. Enjoy it today.
Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Andy North, who's as good as it gets down there, breaking down this stuff. And I think the last thing you heard him say is the most significant, because at some point this will stop being about all of the craziness, and it'll start being about whether or not Tiger Woods can win this. And what he just told you is the guys who got set up, I mean, these things are done randomly.
Sure.
You play in the morning one day and the afternoon the other. He's saying those who got the late tee times today, which includes Tiger Woods, and then the early tomorrow, probably got purely by bad luck the short end of the stick.
I always think that's interesting, especially if weather is coming through those. Obviously, the first couple of days, you have to make the cut to see who does get the what would be perceived as the shorter end of the stick.
Well, I think that hurt him at the U.S. Open last year. Remember the enormous weather they had at Bethpage Black? I think that hurt him a lot.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
The general manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, Neil Huntington, is with us. Everybody say hi to Neil. Welcome. Nice to meet you.
Thanks. Great to be on the show. Thanks for having me on, guys.
And let's start first. What a start. 2-0, big extra innings win last night. Pittsburgh's off to a good start now.
No question. The guys believe in each other. There's a good level of talent here. We won a big game opening night, and then last couple of years, we didn't get the big pitch or the big hit we needed, and last night we got both.
The other thing that's going on today is that Mr. Golic and myself will be throwing out the first pitch before your game, and I trust you've done your scouting. I know you've had your scouts following us. I have thrown two pretty good pitches at Wrigley Field and Progressive Field in my time doing this.
Lollipops.
Golic has failed to reach home plate in either of his attempts. So give us a quick breakdown, if you will, of Golic's mechanics and your thoughts on his first pitch.
Well, if he's left-handed, he's still got a chance.
Unfortunately, I'm right-handed.
Well, I'd say both are past your prime, unfortunately.
I said I'm going to stop throwing the sinker. That's what I was doing. I think my pitch selection has been wrong. I should just go with the heat, right?
You're facing an aggressive hitter with two strikes. You're throwing it in the dirt. It's all right.
I see that. All right, getting him to bite on it. I like that.
Yes, I'm sure a guy will bite. The dirt is one thing. He hit the grass.
I did not. There was a dirt scuff on the ball. I reached the dirt.
Golic's combined pitches, the home plate is 60 feet and 6 inches. So that's basically 121 feet. Golic's combined distance has been about 110 to 150.
Yeah, it's not pretty.
Anyway, let's get to the issue that came up yesterday, and I think you could shed interesting light on. The owner of the Milwaukee Brewers somewhat publicly bemoaned his plight. They're a small market team, and they need to try and resign Prince Fielder at some point fairly soon, young slugger. Scott Boras is his agent, and he said, you know, we're going to have trouble signing Prince Fielder, and the Yankee infield makes more money than we make. To which the president of the Yankees said, hey, Mark, stop whining. We give all of this money in revenue sharing. Where's that money going? So I think you're the perfect person to ask that question to. Where does that money go? Where does the money that you get from the central fund, whether it's the TV money, the revenue sharing, luxury tax, et cetera, where does that money go?
Well, the reality is I can speak on Pittsburgh. I can't speak on behalf of the other teams that take revenue sharing. It goes partially back into our payroll, which this year is dropped all the way to $35 million on decisions that I've made to try to improve this organization, to try to improve this team. Long-term, we're reinvesting into the future. We've spent more money in the draft than anybody in baseball over the last 2 years. We've Bob Nutting. At his wishes, we've built a $5 million facility in the Dominican Republic. We've purchased the Florida State League team. We've added area scouts on the amateur side. We've added professional scouts. We've added player development staff. We've invested significantly in resources to help our young players get better. We're reinvesting. Some of that will be put toward future payrolls, but the bottom line is we're reinvesting every penny we can to make this organization stronger. We inherited an organization that had lost 90-plus games for 5 years. It's in the midst of a 15-year losing streak when we came in here in September of 2007. Had a core of players that were becoming free agents after the 2009 season. We needed to accumulate talent. We've done it through the draft. We've done it through quadrupling our international signing bonus budget. We've done it through facilities, personnel, and systems. And the money's going back into making this organization stronger. It may not be at the major league level, but those are my decisions. Bob Nutting deserves all the credit in the world, our owner, for subjecting himself to the abuse that he's taken over the last couple of years because we've tried to put a winning team back on the field in Pittsburgh.
You know, and I would never, I certainly don't want it to give the impression that we think any money that you guys get should be used on the payroll. Because obviously to build a team, you have to build the structure around it as well. But there are things, if an owner gets money like this and pays down debt with that money, should that be allowed?
Well, the reality is, in our minds, we're focused on building the baseball team. We're focused on reinvesting in talent, whether it's on-field or off-field talent, reinvesting in how we do things, giving ourselves the facilities to be ahead of the curve competitively, reinvesting in the draft. There will come a point in time where our payroll will mature naturally. As Andrew McCutchen and these other players become arbitration eligible, our payroll will return to market-appropriate levels. We're always going to have to be aggressive in the draft. We're always going to have to work. We work as well as we can within the system that we're given. Candidly, without revenue sharing, the Pittsburgh Pirates probably don't exist. The next round of collective bargaining, you'll talk with Rob. Can they improve upon that for the clubs like us? Can they improve upon it big picture? That's their decision. But from our standpoint, it can't be an excuse. From our standpoint, we've got to do what Colorado and Minnesota and Tampa and Oakland did for years. We've got to compete under the system that we're built.
Mike, Neil Huntington is the general manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates. In your view, is there something you could see that could be done differently that would level the playing field in a greater way for the team you manage?
The reality is that we've got to work within the system.
I get that, but I mean, if I said to you, Neil, you're in charge, you can make one decision. Here's one thing that you could change/tweak that would make a significant difference that the average baseball fan may not be aware of. Is there something like that?
Well, I think the easy answer is always going to be a salary cap, but it's probably not going to ever happen in baseball. So we operate under the rules that we're given. We try to be as efficient and effective as we can in our decision-making process, and don't worry about what could be coming. We focus on how do we win under this system.
How about international players in the draft? How much of a difference does that kind of a thing make?
It's going to be a logistical nightmare to put in place, but it certainly does. Just like the draft was intended to equally distribute talent, there may be a point in time now where the international side has to be drawn into the draft in some way, shape, or form.
Just to make sure everyone understands what that means. So if an Aroldis Chapman is coming to the major leagues, he's not just going to go to the highest bidder, but he would go into a draft the way American players would, and thus the Yankees, Red Sox, and et cetera would not automatically have first dibs on guys who are coming in with big reputation.
Are the parameters specific enough on what you guys have to do with the money? I know each team has to turn in a report by April 1st to baseball that they review. And to me, it's always seemed a bit gray with the specific with parameters. Are they specific enough that you have to follow?
Well, I mean, Mike, to your point, I'm sure the union and the players would all love that it has to go back into Major League payroll. But for an organization like us with where we are in our curve, we're getting out of the talent accumulation mode. We're now looking to build a Major League team. We wish we could have snapped our fingers and magically been a 95-win team with the best farm system in baseball. It didn't take 2 years to get to where we were. It's not going to take 2 years to dig out from underneath that. If we had to put that money in Major League payroll, we're probably going to make some bad decisions at the Major League level because we've got to overpay a free agent to get here. The bottom line is we need talent to come through our system. We need to build from within, and then we supplement that via free agency. As long as we're reinvesting those resources into baseball operations, we feel that that's the intent of the rule.
And so to sum up, what you're saying to everyone is every penny you've gotten for Major League Baseball, Central Fund, et cetera, has gone into helping build the Pittsburgh Pirates to be a better baseball team and better organization, even if it's not reflected in your payroll this year.
Absolutely. The payroll this year is reflective of the decisions I made to get more talent into this organization, to give us a foundation to build upon, because teams in this market, they have to build from within and then again supplement via free agency, and that's where our money's going.
Very good. Well, I hope the weather permits us to go out there.
Yeah.
It was supposed to rain on and off today. I hope we're able to get out there so Golic can once again humiliate himself by coming up about 5 feet short.
I do it well.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
Let's get the answers then from a man who knows it. He is the man who oversees this program, the revenue sharing, et cetera, for Major League Baseball. He's their executive vice president of labor relations, Rob Manfred, who's back with us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Good morning, Rob. How are you?
Good morning, guys. I'm great. How are you?
We're good. Thank you. Thanks for taking the time today. And so let's get into let's attack this as generally as we possibly can, and then we will get more specific as need be. Explain to the average baseball fan out there who looks at the disparities in the payrolls and says, and explain to them exactly how it is baseball is doing the best it can to ensure that there is some parity as far as the finances are concerned.
Well, I think that the most important thing to begin with is that for Commissioner Selig, the most important issue is and has been from the beginning of his term in baseball, competitive balance. That's the phrase that is most important to him. Everything that we have done, from a labor relations perspective has been directed at preserving the competitive balance of the game. You know, when I started in this office with Commissioner Selig, we were moving about $70 million in revenue sharing around, and you know, this year we'll move somewhere between $450 and $500 million. Obviously, the competitive balance tax is also a mechanism that's designed to regulate the very high end of our payrolls. And while, you know, we do have one club that pays a lot of tax every year and has, you know, for a number of years, we've had all 29 clubs at or below that tax threshold, which has served to compress payrolls. And I think the results have shown on the field. I mean, in the last 5 years, 20 of our 30 teams have been in the playoffs, been in the postseason. In the last decade, we've had franchises like the Florida Marlins win in 2003. And in 2008, we had Tampa Bay in the World Series. And, you know, you look around at other sports, do you really see the smallest market franchises showing up in the premier events?
You are right about that. We have seen some of that. The issue some people have is those smaller market teams and the consistency of them being able to stay at a high level. And some people, quite obviously, Rob, just can't get past the fact of seeing a $206 million payroll, $162 million payroll, $146 million payroll, and a $34, a $37, or a $51 million payroll. They have a tough time getting past that. So when these teams with the lower payrolls get this money, so now, again, keep it in the, as best layman terms as you can, they get this pile of money to work with. What are the rules? What are the parameters where they need to use this money?
Well, I think the basic agreement, it contains language which says that, you know, in layman's terms, the money must be used in an effort to improve the quality of the product on the field. Let's talk just a little bit, if you'll indulge me, about the numbers, because, you know, people don't have full access to club financial statements, and I think sometimes numbers get thrown around that are not quite accurate. So let me see if I can help you with that just a little bit, okay? Let's take the worst case on this topic. The highest revenue sharing recipient last year received about $43 million, okay? In addition to that $43 million in revenue sharing, which is money that comes from other teams, okay, they receive a net $37 million out of the central fund, okay? So that's roughly $80 million in central money. One thing that's important to remember is the basic agreement provision that I've heard Mike Golic talk about as being gray a number of times really applies only to the $44 million figure. Doesn't apply to the 37,
right?
Okay? Now let's talk about the cost side. So you got $80 million, but let's assume you ought to spend that $80 million making your team better. Okay, people throw around payroll figures. Let's take $40 million, which is at the end of the year that will be the low end of the payroll range because payrolls creep up over the season. $40 million payroll, lowest you're going to have. In addition to that, people forget there's about $5.5 million that is contributed to play. Each team contributes to player pensions and health care. And you know we have the finest pension and health care for our current and former players of any professional sport. So that takes you up, let's just say, round numbers, $45 million, okay? The average expenditure, and you heard Neil talk about this a little bit this morning, the average expenditure in this industry on scouting and player development is $25 million, all right? At that point, you're at $70 million. You heard Neil talk about them being one of the high expenditure clubs. In fact, our lowest revenue clubs spend the most on scouting and player development. Those clubs routinely are above 30 in the $30 to $32 million range. So if you use that number instead of the 25, you're at $78, $79 million, and you've covered the 80. I mean, there just simply is no issue about people taking either revenue sharing and or central fund money and using that for anything other than spending on the field, because every club spends at least that much money.
Mike and Rob Manfred with Inc. A good description there of where the money is going to and ways that it's being used that the average baseball fan may not see. So let's get to a couple of the other things here. You have the owner of the Milwaukee Brewers bemoaning the fact that he's going to have a hard time signing a superstar player, and the New York Yankees are spending all of this money. I guess I would ask you this, and it may be tough to ask you to call out one of your teams, just how much of a problem in this system is the Yankees' willingness to spend the way they are?
look, I the way I think about the problem in the system, and it is a problem, is that baseball has way more revenue disparity than other sports. And the reason for that is simple. We have these 81 local events that occur every year as opposed to, you know, much smaller number in professional football, for example. And it generates revenue disparity. And people with, even after revenue sharing, people, clubs like the Yankees, have more disposable dollars, and there is a single market for players. It's one market, even though you have people with vastly different resources, and that is the central problem that when we get to work every morning, the commissioner is on us to figure out ways to deal with that problem. I mean, that is the core issue that we wrestle with every day. I think that perspective is really important on this issue. Whenever the Yankees win, you know, we have this eruption of concern over the influence of money in the game. But you can't forget that, you know, in 2007, which was only two postseasons ago, we had Arizona, Colorado, Cleveland, and Boston in the league championship series in the two leagues. And three out of four of those teams were really in the bottom third, maybe even bottom quarter of payrolls in the industry. See, you have to look at it over time. And I think that although the system we have is not perfect and we will continue to strive to make it better, and that's our challenge every day, we have made big progress on it, and we have had a wide variety of our teams qualify for the postseason.
Rob, we have a hard break here. Can you hold on? Can we continue this in a couple of minutes?
Yeah, I'll do whatever you guys would like.
Terrific.
Thanks,
Let's
Rob.
Put Rob. We appreciate that very much. He's Rob Manfred. He is the Executive Vice President of Labor Relations for Major League Baseball. There's a lot more to get to here. We appreciate him being accommodating. We'll come back with more with him in a moment. Mike and Mike in the
morning. ESPN Radio.
And like Rob Manfred, who's the Major League Baseball Executive VP of Labor Relations, good enough to stay with us for a few extra minutes here, and he continues with us on Mike and Mike in the Morning. Rob, we appreciate you being so accommodating. And so just sort of to recap the conversation we've been having about competitive balance in baseball and some really interesting answers that you gave us, which is the most important of which was to clarify, people talk about the $80 million that a team will get from Major League Baseball and Central Fund. Well, about $37 million of that money comes from the national TV contracts, et cetera. So teams can spend that any way they want.
Exactly.
The lowest payroll team got $43 million.
And that's the money we're talking about, what they do. And also, he's absolutely right that this comes about when the Yankees are winning.
Right.
And I completely agree with him, and I've said it before. It's not the Yankees are following the rules. What they're doing, any fan would want their owner to do. If you got the money and you're going to go spend it on the players, spend it.
So that's a summary of where we've been. Rob Manfred continues with us. And again, Rob, we appreciate it. So let's just ask this question, because there have been some questions. Are you and Major League Baseball satisfied that all of the teams who are receiving the revenue sharing money are using it in appropriate fashion?
Look, we are satisfied with that, and I think the most – it's really important to understand the process that we go through each year with the Major League Baseball Players Association in order to make sure that the clubs have complied with the basic agreement. First and most important, we have never had a grievance on this topic. We had an issue with one team this past winter, which was resolved without actually having a formal grievance. But we've never had a grievance on the topic. And trust me, if the MLBPA and Mike Weiner, for whom I have great respect, thought that this money was not being used consistent with the basic agreement, he would challenge us on that. Each club each year submits a detailed report to this office along with complete financial statements. Both the reports and the statements go to the Players Association as well. They comb through these reports. They analyze them. They spend a lot of time with them. We then meet face-to-face, the commissioner's office representatives with the Players Association, to discuss the teams, discuss what the teams are saying to us in terms of how the money is used. The union often asks us to go back to the teams, say we need to know more information. And candidly, we go out with the union and meet with some teams who take us through in detail what their plan is, not only this year, but long term, in order to make sure that these resources are being used in an appropriate way. And while the language does not contain, and I listen to you guys every morning, so I hear you over time, you know, the language is not precise in the sense that it requires you to spend X dollars in X year. That was on purpose, because the way baseball works, and the way baseball particularly works in small markets, is that these teams have to go through cycles where their payrolls go down, they develop young players, and then they bring along a cadre of players that they hope will make them competitive over a number of years. So that's a long answer that boils down to, yes, we are satisfied.
If an owner in his, I don't know if they put it in the report or how they would, you would find out, if you found out an owner was using some of that money to pay down debt, how would that be received?
Well, look, I think that the issue of actually taking, first of all, that's a purely hypothetical from my perspective. We have never seen a set of numbers from a club that suggested that was the case. I took you through the numbers sort of to demonstrate mm-hmm. that. Having said that, I think that the use of the revenue sharing proceeds for pure debt retirement would raise an issue under this language that I think would be a very difficult issue with the Players Association. As I said, we've never had that kind of circumstance.
Rob Manfred, we really appreciate you taking the time today and clarifying this. We appreciate you being there to answer these questions. And certainly, as this continues to be a topic of discussion, we'd love to continue to discuss it with you. Thanks a million for the time today.
Love to be on any time. Thanks again, guys.
All right, there's Rob Manfred with us, Executive VP of Labor Relations. I think that's interesting stuff. You're always going to get, the moment it happens, the moment they say things like, well, we have a level of competitive balance that other leagues can't match, the emails will come flying in.
Yeah.
Indianapolis and New Orleans played in the Super Bowl last year. Those are small markets. We know that. San Antonio has had a dynastic run. That's a small market. We know that. The reality is, and Rob Manfred just said it, and he won't go as far along in saying it as he inside knows it's true, it's a problem. I mean, it's clearly a problem. It's been a problem since the inception of the game, and he told you why. Because it is the only sport where one team or some teams generate so much more money than the other teams for reasons that are nobody's fault. The reality is that this commissioner and this group of people have done infinitely more to make a dent in that problem, I don't want to say solve the problem that hasn't been solved, to make a dent in the problem than had ever been done before in the history of the game. They need to continue working toward it. He just said they're satisfied that all the money that's being shared is going to the right places. If that's accurate, if that is indeed the case, then I think the fan has to feel fairly good about that.
Well, I think where fans go is they see in other sports where other systems may work a little better, and you know what two words I'm going to use, and that's salary cap. They see other leagues doing that, and they say they think it's a little more competitive. And Rob correctly pointed out the number of teams, even small market teams, that have made the postseason. But again, as other people will answer to that, well, what about consistency? Yeah, they're there for a year. The Marlins win it for a year and then basically disband.
Right.
But then, by God, a few years later, they win it again. I mean, but people look for that consistency. And so everybody, baseball to the unions, to everybody, admits it's not the perfect scenario. But the problem is agreeing on what a better one is. Because when you start to think about what would be a better one side may not think so for their, you know, particular reason.
For the purposes of this discussion, what we hope you found somewhat enlightening, if we learned anything, is how exactly it is they calculate what the money it is these teams are supposed to be getting from revenue sharing, how it's being used, and whether or not you think the team you root for is using it in an appropriate way. Meanwhile, Rob Manfred has always been one of our favorite people for reasons that have nothing to do with this.
Yeah, yeah.
He was testifying before Congress during the steroid hearings, the legendary, you know, Mark McGuire, Rafael mm-hmm. Palmeiro steroid hearings. And a congressman named Elijah Cummings from the state of Maryland.
He's our favorite congressman.
Became our favorite congressman because in the questioning he said this.
Let's talk to you, Mr. Manfred, on ESPN Radio, Mike and Mike Show, yesterday.
And we,
that's all we care. We
stopped listening.
Yeah, we don't care what
point.
He said. We have no, we care less what he said.
At that moment, I didn't even hear what he said because the next words were yesterday. You said.
Yeah.
And then literally, I don't care what he said.
No.
I don't know what he said on our show 6 years ago, and I don't care.
Okay, we're in the books.
But it got us mentioned
yeah.
during a congressional hearing.
Uh-huh.
As far as I'm concerned, that's cause to love
him. That's a win, absolutely.